Welcome to the University of Washington's Political Economy Forum. We bring together diverse scholars, policymakers, and citizens to discuss current public policy issues, to inform the public about them, and to find evidence-based solutions. Feel free to visit our website at uwpoliticaleconomy.com. We publish new episodes of this podcast every week. If you have questions or suggestions for discussion topics, please contact us on Twitter at ForumUW or email us at uwpoliticaleconomy@gmail.com. We would love to hear from you. Hello everyone, my name is Nicholas Wittstock. I'm a fellow at the Forum, and in today's episode I speak to Danielle Markowitz, who is the Guido Calabresi Professor of Law at Yale Law School and the author of The Meritocracy Trap: How America's Foundational Myth Feeds Inequality, Dismantles the Middle Class, and Devours the Elite. This is a conversation that I was personally extremely excited about, and you will hear that Professor Markowitz is a fantastically insightful person. I can greatly recommend this book to anyone listening, and I'm sure that you will enjoy the conversation.
Hello, Danielle Markowitz.
Hi, it's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, we're very happy to have you on. Daniel, you're the author of The Meritocracy Trap, a book that picks up several themes that contemporary Americans care greatly about: income inequality, the state of democratic institutions, political polarization, as well as deindustrialization, alongside, you know, the emergence of very lucrative jobs in some areas. Your op-eds in The Atlantic describe how the current U.S. economy is neither serving the bottom nor the middle, and provocatively, you argue not even the top end of workers. You describe the ever-rising demands for education, geographic and time flexibility, which lead either to burnout or to people somehow wearing this as a badge of honor and making busyness part of their identity. I'd say many of these topics have been problematized by commentators, but your diagnosis of the root cause is unique, in that you charge meritocracy as a crucial culprit. So the idea of advancing the best and the brightest based on their performance. So what is wrong with meritocracy, and how is it connected to some of these pathologies?
Yeah, great. That's a great way to frame this. In part, you're asking what's wrong with meritocracy because it seems so obviously an appealing idea that, you know, people should get ahead based on their accomplishments, not, say, their parents' social class or their race or their gender or their ethnicity. And that's obviously, in a sense, true. It seems like if you have a system like that, it creates an elite that's very capable, that will serve society as a whole. And you create a competition in which everybody has a fair chance of success, so that meritocracy and equality of opportunity are often thought to align. Mm-hmm. In meritocracy's early years, it sort of worked that way. In the US, meritocracy really got going in the post-World War II years, and it was promoted by reformers. There was an old elite, which was really aristocratic. It excluded all people of color, women, Jews, Catholics, Southern European immigrants. It was not very capable. The sons got into Harvard because their parents had gone to Harvard, their fathers had gone to Harvard. The meritocracy was the way of opening up that elite to outsiders, giving people a fair shot at getting in, and then creating a new elite, which was much more capable than the old one. And initially, that's how meritocracy worked. And we can talk about the details later on if you want. But here's the critical thing. The reason meritocracy opened up the old elite is that, to be blunt, the aristocrats weren't very smart and weren't very hardworking. So when you opened up advantage and opportunity to talent and effort, new people came in. But the people who succeeded at the meritocracy, the meritocrats themselves, they are hardworking, and they know how to educate their kids, mm-hmm. and they have an almost unlimited appetite for educating and training their kids. And so what's happened is that the next generation of meritocrats, and then the next generation after that, and the next generation after that, now invest astonishing sums of money and astonishing amounts of effort and skill at training up their kids in a way in which nobody else can match. And so on the one hand, what happens is that means that being born to an elite family is almost a necessary condition for success in your own life, because education and training works, and only rich parents are in a position to give their kids the kind of training that they need to succeed in a hyper-competitive meritocracy. On the other hand, even those kids themselves, you know, they're trained to within an inch of their lives. And that's the part of the story that makes it also the case that this system doesn't serve the elite. So it's a system that excludes almost everyone from meaningful access to advantage, and then exploits those whom it gives advantage in a way that doesn't serve their human interests. And that's the rough outline of this. And we can talk about the mechanics of it. And we can also, if you're interested, talk about the sort of classic Marxist reinterpretation of it. Those are all different ways of getting at the problem, but I've sort of set out the basic problem now.
Amazing. Yeah, I'm definitely going to come back to exactly those points in just a moment. But to reiterate, your point being that those with the most resources ultimately win the meritocratic game and then in effect almost reinstitute an aristocracy of sorts, where people with fewer resources cannot really shape up in competition.
Yeah, look, I mean, just to be really concrete, the average public school in America spends between $12,000 and $15,000 per student per year educating its kids. The average of the Forbes top 20 private schools spends about $75,000 per student per year educating its kids. And whereas it probably used to be the case that those elite schools spent the money frivolously on balls and, you know, Corvettes for driver's ed or something like that, now what these schools do is they ruthlessly deploy those funds to squeeze as much training into students as possible.
Right.
They revisit the social psychology of education every summer. They rejigger their curricula. They decide what balance of free play and creative work and drill best maximizes student learning. And, you know, education works. And the people who are given a lot of it turn out to do really well at tests and things. And that means that, yes, if you don't get that education, you either have to be unbelievably lucky or just preternaturally talented to compete with kids who do get that education.
Right. But you point out in very impressive accounts how incredibly hard the top end is working, right, to sustain that advantage. So it's clearly not free. At the same time, I would say, you know, a knee-jerk reaction to this account could be to point out that, you know, poverty in the United States has declined since mid-century, which is sort of a reference point that you use in the book to make some of the comparative points. Political institutions have become much more inclusive, especially of minorities. More people in the U.S. than ever before have access to consumer goods, many of which didn't even exist, you know, even just 20 years ago. You know, products have become better, safer. There are even some recent accounts who put some doubt on the numbers of people like Piketty and Saez on the increase of income inequality, right? So especially if you take into account post-tax and transfer incomes. So, you know, you could make the argument that meritocracy is working for the U.S. So what's the problem here?
Yeah, I think there are two parts of that story you've just told, which one wants to separate. The first part concerns the decline of poverty, material poverty, absolute poverty, and also the decline of categorical caste-based exclusion. Mm-hmm. So overt racism as a way of blocking people with certain racial identities from accessing institutions, jobs, advantage. And progress has been made on both fronts. Although it remains true that the US has more absolute poverty than other similarly rich countries. And it remains true that there's a great deal of overt racism in our society. And there's still a lot of categorical exclusion of various sorts. But still, real progress has been made. That concerns the gap between the worst off and the middle class, roughly speaking, and that's diminished. On the other hand, there's the gap between the middle class and the rich. Mm-hmm. And this is a question not of poverty, but of concentrated wealth, extreme privilege. And there's no question that that gap has increased dramatically. You're right that there is a question whether some of Piketty's estimates are quite as, whether the extreme he reports is quite as extreme as he reports it. But there are also ways in which he underreports elite advantage. And on balance, the story he tells of concentrated privilege in a very narrow elite is unquestionably basically true. And it's true not just in flat economic terms. It's also true in terms of cultural isolation, control of power institutions, control of the political process, You know, when Robert Dahl studied New Haven, Connecticut's political process in the 60s, he discovered that the rich did not have much more power than anybody else did, than the middle class did. Whereas today, there's simply no question that both at the city level and at the state level and at the national level, people who control massive amounts of campaign contributions and also lobbying and lawyers and bankers to manipulate the way the state deals with them have rendered themselves almost ungovernable. And that kind of concentrated economic power and privilege is a real problem for a society. And it's a problem independent of how badly off the worst off are.
Absolutely. I want to push you on the question whether it's really meritocracy that is driving some of these trends you describe. Usually, I would say in most accounts of political economy, similar stories as the one that you're telling are told as one of technological change paired with, you know, increased global trade and resulting competition. So the 1970s, for example, saw the introduction of the general purpose technology of the computer. And now, you know, the internet and different forms of machine learning. So the argument usually goes that these technologies have eliminated a lot of routine jobs. And this has made it so that salaries of those who can operate computer programs or statistical packages, for example, have seen their salaries explode. Whereas, you know, the demand for a lot of mid-skill jobs has declined. On the other hand, though, demand for in-person, non-routine, low-skill jobs has also increased. At the same time, you know, we've seen a dramatic increase in education spending and attendance because the returns to education have gone up so tremendously. So shouldn't your book really be called, you know, knowledge economy or something like that? Isn't that really sort of the ultimate causal driver here?
So that's a fantastic question. And I think one of the features of the argument that I make that I should say I believe wholeheartedly, but is most unconventional and would be most controversial if people focused on it, although it's, I think, a little bit buried in the book and maybe a little bit abstract, and so people haven't focused on it, is the following. The technological change that you're describing has clearly occurred. Mm-hmm. And the question is why?
Right.
And I think the dominant view among economists, but also among others who think about the question, is that it's something in the basic nature of the technology. That as technology becomes more advanced, because advanced is associated with complex, it by its nature favors elite skills and intensive education. And so it's a world in which we have rapid technological advance is also going to be a world in which we have a rapid increase in the dispersion of wages and a shift of wages away from mid-skilled workers and in favor of super-skilled workers. And I don't believe that's true in the following sense. I think it's a contingent question what kinds of skills technological innovation favors. Now, there's no doubt that that's been true historically. The first industrial revolution favored unskilled workers and disfavored skilled artisans. You know, that's why the Luddites were angry at the scribbling machines and the looms. That's why the gunsmiths were angry and the clocksmiths were angry because they were skilled. And what factory production did is it enabled their skills to be replaced by unskilled workers. Now, my claim is that the reason that happened, in fact, is that there was a new army of unskilled labor available. The move to the cities in England, the potato famine in Ireland, generated a massive reserve army of unskilled workers and innovators. Responding to the opportunity created by this labor supply, invented technologies that could use this labor supply. Today, we're in the opposite position, as it were. Meritocratic explosion in elite training has created a new and unprecedented supply of super skilled workers. And so the reason why technology now favors their skills is that this labor supply exists. If the labor supply didn't exist, innovation would pursue other kinds of workers. So there's a kind of a feedback loop between elite education and the concentration of training, and incidentally also social norms, which make it socially acceptable for elite workers to work very long hours, that has created this new supply of super skilled labor, which technology has bent its arc to meet. Mm-hmm. we had a different skill profile in our workforce, we would have different technologies, which might be just as advanced and just as intricate and just as complex, but would have the feature that they make it possible for mid-skilled labor to be more productive, rather than that they are complements for super-skilled labor and substitutes for mid-skilled labor. I can tell the story of this transformation sort of micro histories in different industries to give a sense for why I think that this is what's happened. But that's the claim. And obviously reasonable people can reject it, not least because reasonable people do reject it. but I still think it's true.
Right. Yeah, I think one really provocative claim, I suppose, that is adjacent to this one is your observation that there's really a lot of different ways you can solve a problem, right? Like you can solve it either with very high skilled problem solvers, as in workers, right? Or you can solve it with a couple more mid-skilled workers. And it's not a priori obvious which one is the better one for the consumer or for society at large, which I think at the very least is extremely interesting.
Right. I mean, so this is a claim, you know, if you look at science and technology studies, the people in science and technology studies find the view that I'm pushing here quite familiar and compelling. You know, it's in a way, it's the opposite, you know, the field of dreams story. If you build it, they will come. But this is a story, if they'll come, you'll build it.
Right.
Right. And so that's the story that's happening here. The super skilled workers come, and so the technologists build it.
Right. Or if they don't come, the technology doesn't catch on or something like that.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
Absolutely. So when you describe some of the labor market pathologies, it strikes me that many of the issues to describe might possibly be a function of American labor law and the weakness of labor unions in particular. So, you know, issues like the surveillance of workers, long hours, few holidays, expectations of flexibility may be ameliorated by increased labor power, right? So recent research, for example, by people like Eric Posner of University of Chicago, who showed the pervasiveness of monopsony power of employers in many U.S. labor markets, has motivated calls, for example, for antitrust action. What about your story is missed by such reform efforts?
Yeah, so two things. First of all, I'm in favor of those reforms. Now I'm just revealing my personal politics. but I want to be open about that. I'm in favor of those reform efforts. I am not sure that they will be sufficient to solve the problems they're trying to address. Or if they are, it won't be for the mechanism that they believe are the case. So let's talk there. And then there's another set of problems that we should also talk about. First of all, with respect to mid-skilled and low-skilled labor, there's no question, in my mind at least, that employer market power significantly contributes to the depression of wages. Mm-hmm. And that strengthening labor through regulation, through encouraging unionization, will enable some pushback. But here's an important thing about this. It won't enable pushback over the long run to the point at which the technological changes that you're describing will be overcome. That is to say, if it turns out that technological changes make it the case that a super skilled worker plus robots and algorithms can be as productive or more productive than a bunch of mid-skilled workers, no amount of unionization will get the mid-skilled workers their jobs back. Right. So what actually needs to happen is there needs to be a serious set of educational policies, labor market policies, and industrial policies and innovation policies that increase the productivity of mid-skilled workers. That's the critical thing. Now, interestingly, there is a sense in which unionization might contribute to that. And this is something I think the people on the left don't appreciate enough, which is this. What a union does is it sets the worker's wage above her marginal product in the short term, right?
At least for some workers.
At least for some. Now, notice what that does. When you have a perfectly functioning labor market in which workers' wages are set at marginal product, then any increase in worker productivity is shared between the worker and the employer. So if the employer invests in new technology and capital deepening that increases the worker's product, some of that return goes to the worker. But in a unionized shop where the worker's wage is set by a political compromise, the employer becomes the 100% claimant of increases in worker productivity. So ironically, one thing that unions do is they give an employer incentive precisely to invest in technology, in capital, and other forms right. of technology that will increase the workers' productivity. Mm-hmm. And that's a very important long-term effect. So on the topic you're talking about, I'm in favor of unionization. I'm in favor of regulation to protect workers. But I think we need more in addition right. to that. The other thing that this line of argument simply doesn't pick up is that there are lots of sectors of the economy in which there is actually enormous worker power. Partners at law firms, managing directors at Goldman Sachs. These people have outside options. They can, in fact, walk away. They're rich enough that they can just stop. And yet, they are also constantly surveilled. Mm-hmm. They are also expected to work endless hours, to be available all the time. You know, the life of a super elite American finance worker, if you took away the pay, would be viewed by every friend of labor as a fundamental violation of worker rights. Now, it may be that when you're paid enough, it no longer violates your rights. That's a perfectly plausible position to take, but it doesn't make the job, in a human sense, a good job. And so we need an explanation for why that's happened. Why are these people willing to work that hard? Right. Why does our society valorize it? What's going on in our imaginative world that people pursue this form of life?
I wanted to bring up this point a little bit later, but now that you mention it, I want to push back there, right? Because this seems to slightly go against part of your argument, right? Which is that the current labor regime is not even favoring the top end. You quote Keynes, for example, who famously predicted that his grandchildren would only work a couple of hours a week and live a life of dignified leisure because they would be so productive, you know, that they could afford to do so. But today, right, as you point out also just now, it seems that the more productive you get, the more you work, right? And you document that there's been somewhat of a shift of working hours from low-skill labor towards high-skill labor, which we've also spoken about just now. But at the same time, right, you've mentioned it now, if I'm a highly paid data scientist, for example, at Google, if I'm a partner at McKinsey, if I'm working at Kirkland & Ellis or something like that, if these people really wanted to work less, I'm sure they'd find a way, right, and still be able to somehow live a historically unprecedentedly comfortable life. Right. Like even if you just live off of the, 5% investment returns of the money that they should really theoretically be able to save. Right. They would still be extremely comfortable. So it seems to me that it's possible that, you know, Keynes was possibly just wrong in his psychological assessment here. Right. That these people are deriving enormous, pleasure from working in these conditions that seem obsessive from the outside. But maybe that's just who these people are.
So I think that's a very good question. Here's my response, but I want to be clear that, you know, what we're now doing is we're interpreting a form of human experience and what it's like from the inside, which means that there's no proof to be had. Nevertheless, first of all, when you talk to people in those jobs, they don't give the impression or say that they're delighted with the shape of their lives. I have asked them, would you trade 30% less income for 25 hours a week of leisure? They all say yes. Of course, they don't do it, but they all say yes. So that's point one. Point two, and now you have to think about your own values and your sense of what's a successful and flourishing life. I simply can't credit when I think as a moral person, as a moral philosopher, I have training in philosophy also. It just strikes me as incredible that a life spent 80, 90 hours a week all through middle age, servicing the at best amoral, possibly immoral interests of global capital, doing whatever tasks you're assigned in order to maximize the return for an entity, not even a human being, it is a fulfilled and flourishing life. Now, maybe I've limited imagination. I'm sure I do. But I don't think it's just the intellectual's prejudice here. I think very few people who heard that description of life would say, yeah, that's the thing that a human being should aim at. And then the third point is, look, we are not just an economy, but also a social and status economy. And the people who do those jobs have gone through the private schools that you and I discussed earlier, and have from very early on had their character and their worldview shaped by a competitive need to please others who evaluate them. And, you know, in order to succeed, they've had to chase grades and test scores and recommendations and internships and promotions. And that produces an interior worldview in which you keep chasing whatever the marker of success is without forming an independent judgment about what's worth doing. And so I can rationalize why it is that people keep doing this even when they have outside options by accounting for the way in which your character is shaped by going through this system. And that fact, plus the fact that I just can't see how this is a life that actually is ideal or close to ideal, leads me to think they're not doing well, even though you're quite right, in some flat sense, they have the freedom to walk away.
Right. I mean, I completely share your bewilderment, and I find it extremely hard to imagine that this is a very just fulfilling experience. At the same time, you bring up an additional point why this may be a gilded cage of sorts, why it's a meritocracy trap, which is your analysis of the importance of human capital, or how human capital is categorically different from other sorts of capital and how they function. And that you argue that it's contra people like Piketty or Zucman, that it's not so much capital that is really the main driver of top incomes. I suppose it doesn't matter whether it's the main driver or not, but you say that it's a significant driver is very, very elite human capital or very, very well-educated people that have very, very high skill. Explain that.
Yeah, sure. So there's a question of just the flat data, and then there's a conceptual question here. So the question of the flat data goes to how should one understand certain important categories of elite income? Wages are obviously labor income.
Mm-hmm.
You know, rents on, say, real estate holdings or dividends from stocks are obviously capital. But there's a large class of elite workers who are owner workers of often professional firms that are passed through entities for tax purposes, partners at law firms,
mm-hmm.
partners at a place like McKinsey, owners of doctors' medical practices.
Mm-hmm.
We're also doctors there. And the question there, just in terms of the data, is how does one allocate that income between capital and labor? And Piketty and his co-authors allocated it one way, which I think treats it more as capital than it should be. And I allocated another way, which treats a greater share of that as labor. Probably a paper that, if you want a third party as another judge, Yagen and Zwick have a paper called Capitalists in the 21st Century, which allocates this yet another way and comes out with the conclusion that over half of the 1% income is from labor. So that's the first. Now there's a second question, which is not, that's just a data question. But there's a second question, which is more conceptual and interpretive, which is this. Suppose I work at a hedge fund.
Mm-hmm.
I don't own the capital that I'm managing. But my wage or my income is not technically a wage. My income is a share of the return on that capital. Now, what happens is the owners of the capital agree to pay me a share of the return on the capital in exchange for my labor in managing their money. That's the 2 and 20. How should we understand that income? Is it capital income or labor income? Similarly, if I am an elite executive at a large company and I get paid in stock options, my income is actually, in some sense, an appreciation on the capital of those stock options. But it's also paid to me in exchange for my labor. Now, Piketty tends to treat that income as capital because he's an economist. And from the mechanics of it, in a way, it is a return on capital.
Mm.
I tend to treat that income as labor income because in some sense, I'm a political philosopher, a political theorist. And what I'm asking is, from within the ideology of meritocracy,
right,
does the person who does that job and the society that creates that job think of that person as a rentier who's inherited a factory and is extracting income from other people's labor. Or think of that person as a worker who is selling his labor on the market in exchange for a price.
Right.
And my view is the right way to think of that person is a worker selling her labor on the market in exchange for a price. It's just the price is set through a mechanism that makes reference to capital.
Yeah, that makes sense, right? And then the reason why I bring it up now is that this is part of your argument as to why people are trapped in that cycle, right? Because ultimately, the only way that they can really cash in on their capital is to continuously work.
Right.
And that's also why, you know, that there is an effort to educate your children as much, because that is really how you succeed at that top end or in that particular labor market.
Right. And the critical difference there, just to be very express about it, is that if I own a factory or land, I can mix my capital with somebody else's labor and extract a portion of the return as rent.
Right.
But if what I own is my own skills, talent, training, even my own social capital and network position, it's very hard under current technology for me to extract income from that human capital,
right,
except by mixing it with my own contemporaneous labor. And so to go back to the elite workers and the question, why don't they just walk away? Well, part of the answer is they're faced with two very stark alternatives. Either they continue to work all the time, or they give up on all the income from their capital,
right,
from their human capital, right? Whereas what the Vantier had was they had an intermediate position, which is my estate will be a little less well managed. People will skim off the top, but I'll still get a big return on my capital. And so a lot of them chose the intermediate option, which gave them both their freedom and their income. Whereas today's elite has to choose between their freedom and their income.
Right. To come back to one of the points that we were discussing just before, in the book, you also contrast other activities of or values of current elites with the preoccupation of the leisure class. That was primarily concerned with status-related exploit, right, in the pre-meritocratic era. Today, I mean, we've talked about this, right, like industry and effort are really valorized, which has not always been the case, which I think is really important to point out, and you do a fantastic job in the book. However, what I wanted to press you on was there's a variety of accounts that see, you know, the current elite's obsession with education, specifically from, you know, Ivy League schools, as something like pointless effort, which is the definition of exploit. You make the case, you know, that people who go to Yale really ultimately end up that much better than people who go somewhere else, right? So you really make the case that this education works. This is not, you know, some pointless showboating. So how do you make that case?
Yeah, look, so first of all, it's obviously both things. It's obviously on the one hand, the case that if you go to Harvard, you get the Harvard network. Whereas if you go to Essex County Community College outside Princeton, New Jersey, you get the Essex County Community College network. And the economic value of those two networks is vastly different.
Mm-hmm.
Right? The human value is probably about the same. You know, you get a community, you get a culture, you get friends, you get lots of valuable things, but the economic value is vastly different.
Right.
And that's a real thing. The question is there another real thing? Which is that the intensity of training that Harvard gives you a set of skills. And I'll say something about what I mean by skill in a moment, but for the moment, let's assume that skills are real things. So it gives you a set of skills that you don't get elsewhere. And here, I should be open and reveal, you know, given where I sit in my biases, I believe education works. I believe as an educator. You know, I see students come in, they get better at the tasks that I set them over time. When I watch my own children go through school, they learn. And when they're taught energetically and well, they learn more than when they're not.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the market has some evidence for this. There's no particular reason. You know, law, for example, is extremely competitive among law firms. In fact, in recent memory, you know, the highest grossing, the most profitable law firm in the world today is, at least large firms, Wachtell, Lipton, Rosen, and Katz. At the moment now, something like 90% of its partners went to, I have to go back in the day to get this claim exactly right, but went to a top 10 law school, roughly speaking. What are the origins of that firm? Well, the origins of that firm, at least if you believe the sort of folklore of the bar, is that it was founded by a group of Jews who found that they couldn't get employed by the old aristocratic white shoe law firms, right? So it was founded chasing talent. In some sense, people were trying to find a way to work, but they also saw, hey, I see an opportunity, because if everybody else is discriminating, here's a talent pool that I can hire that I couldn't hire otherwise because I'm an upstart. And if the incumbents weren't discriminating, they'd take this. And I'm going to make myself the most profitable law firm in the world. And a firm with those origins surely would go after talent elsewhere if it could find it. Why does it hire only at Harvard and Yale and Stanford and Columbia? Well, because that's where the best trained lawyers come out of. It's not because they're better people. It's because the intensity of the education that they get is very great, and education is effective. Now, one last thing before we move on. I said I would talk about what skills are. Now, that, of course, assumes that the thing that makes you a profitable worker in our economy is in some fundamental objective sense a skill. That may not be true, right? We may have rejiggered our economy in such a way that the things that Yale Law School gives its students are valuable, but you could have a better economy in which they weren't valuable. If you want a very concrete example of this, think about baseball. Somebody who can throw a ball 60 feet with speed and accuracy can make $25 million a year, but only if the game baseball exists. If the game baseball did not exist, that person would not be a skilled person, because that skill has no other value, right? You know, baseball pitchers are not, you know, you don't look at a baseball pitcher and say, oh, if that person weren't a baseball pitcher, well, they'd be the center forward for Juventus, or they'd win the Olympics in high jump. No, you look at them, you're like, they have no particular skills except, right? So the idea is that a lot of the skills that the people at Goldman Sachs have, that the people who run big American companies have, that the partners at Wachtell have, would not be valuable if we didn't have this extreme form of meritocratic inequality.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. You make a connection between the meritocratic valorization of a specific kind of expertise and the anti-expert backlash of recent populist movements. So we have mentioned them briefly, but what are some of the other political implications of meritocracy or its pathologies as you describe them?
Yeah, maybe I should say a little bit about the populist point.
Please.
I think that this happens along a series of axes. So the first is, this is something that people on the left have always thought surprising about Donald Trump. You know, it's just, you know, why do middle-class Americans and American workers like Donald Trump? And he's obviously born to great privilege. Why do they see him as one of them? And, you know, there are lots of possible explanations. And, you know, some people say it has to do with a deep vein of racism in American society, which strikes me as both descriptively true about American society and possibly to explain some support for Trump. But I don't think all. It certainly doesn't explain the fact that, for example, Trump did better among African-American voters in 2020 than he did in 2016, did better among Latino voters in 2020 than he did in 2016. So here's what I think is going on. Trump was born to privilege, but he's an old-fashioned aristocrat. He's not a meritocrat. He inherited wealth. And if you're a middle-class American, I think you have the accurate perception that the people who are damaging your opportunities and your children's opportunities are not the people who have inherited wealth. And they're not the entrepreneurs who start huge businesses. They're actually not the billionaires. They're the army of lawyers and doctors and university professors and managers and accountants who are all, you know, making $250,000 a year to $10 million a year, who are trading on degrees from institutions that your kids can't get into because they went to high schools that you couldn't afford to send your kids to. And Trump and the populace are attacking that army of credentialed, institutionalized elites. And the fact that Trump himself is enormously privileged in ways that are unjust, maybe unjust, but it's not the injustice that it's not the injustice to keeping the middle class down. Mm-hmm. And there's a sense in which Trump's middle class supporters, I think, have a more accurate understanding of his role in the political economy of our society than his elite detractors.
Right.
So that's one thing that's going on. I think another thing that's going on is that when you have an elite like this that is deeply institutionalized, that claims that its expertise justifies its position, but is producing outcomes that are very bad for the middle of a society, then the combination of the elite's sort of self-aggrandizing smugness and the outcomes that it's producing for everybody else, together with the fact that it's doing really well,
right,
will give expertise, training, technocratic capacity a bad name. You know, I mean, the crass version of this is that one elite said that the Gulf War would be a good idea, and it obviously wasn't. Another elite said that mortgage-backed securities would be a good idea, and they obviously weren't. Mm. Now we've had an elite, whatever you want to say about the politics of it, it has not managed the pandemic in a particularly successful way. And so, you know, elite after elite after elite has been discredited.
Yeah, I think an additional issue that you describe is that, you know, the people that win this game work extremely hard. So their willingness to part with some portion of their income in form of taxes might be lower than in a different context, because they feel like, well, I've worked so hard for this, right? Yeah. Additionally, the problem is that meritocracy implicitly says that, well, if you can't make it, right, that's really your own fault, right? Like, you should have gone to school, if you will, right? That's sort of the answer that you get. And I think, you know, resentment then in that form against the winners, against the degree havers, you know, I think sounds plausible to me that explains a big part of resentment.
Well, that's another very important part of it, the psychology of this. You know, Michael Young wrote about this when he coined the term meritocracy, that what meritocracy does is, he said, it leaves the underclass morally naked. Mm-hmm. You know, what racism does is, if I'm excluded based on my race, I can say correctly, but also in a way that promotes my own position, this is unjust.
Right.
Universal principles of human equality favor my position. Mm-hmm. But if I'm excluded under meritocracy and everybody's saying it's because I wasn't hardworking enough or skilled enough or virtuous enough, it's much harder for me to say this is unjust. And so meritocracy sort of adds a kind of a moral insult to economic injury. And that insult distorts the moral and political psychology of people on both sides of the divide. I mean, the trick is to come up with a diagnosis of meritocracy that shows, no, actually, it is unjust. It's not your fault that you're not getting ahead. It's not because you're not capable enough. It's not because you're not virtuous enough. It's because there's a whole system that is structured to exclude you. But that diagnosis is necessary before the moral psychology can get more hopeful.
Yeah, absolutely. The issue that I see is that at the same time, you know, obviously we need experts, right? We need expertise. We need people who know their areas very well. So what I want to close on is a discussion of what the alternative really is, because obviously it cannot be to say, you know, we need to valorize the opposite of expertise. That cannot be the solution. So you make a whole bundle of suggestions of what policy or regulation or legal changes, whatever it is, cultural changes as well. What do you think is the way forward?
Yeah, let me start in this conversation with something more general than particular policies. You know, we need to distinguish between superiority and excellence. So what our meritocracy does is it worships superiority. It doesn't matter. Superiority has this feature. It doesn't matter whether the thing you're superior at is good or not. You can still be superior. And as soon as you're better than somebody else, their superiority goes away. It's a competitive, it's a rank concept. And so we structure our advantage around superiority at all sorts of tasks. Am I a superior derivatives trader? No matter that probably derivatives don't benefit the economy. Am I a superior form of, say, open heart surgeon? No matter that our population's heart health would be better off if we diverted resources away from open heart surgery and towards diet, exercise, and life coaches. Right. So the real alternative to meritocracy is for us to decide collectively in a politics what things are worth doing. What capacities do we need as a society? And then to develop an educational system which trains people to do the things that are worth doing well enough to make them worth doing. So we would have many more local bankers for finance and many fewer Wall Street traders. We would have many more nurse practitioners and dietitians and personal trainers and many fewer specialist doctors. What we would do is we would have a society in which jobs are allocated based on ability to do them well, not based on class or caste or race. So that part of meritocracy would be kept. But the jobs themselves would be framed and described in such a way that they were worth doing. And we have an education system that would make many people able to do them well.
So a curious thing that I noticed when discussing some of these suggestions with people is that on the one hand, you know, there's a very knee-jerk reaction against people having the feeling that you want to take something away from them, right? In the sense that like, well, I want to be able to educate my children in the best way, for example. And the other thing that I noticed was that even people who are convinced that the United States is a functioning democracy acknowledge the enormous power that elites have to dictate policy, right? To influence, to get their preferences primarily heard in the political system, which sort of comes out in this assessment that, well, you know, with these kinds of suggestions, you're not going to get any elite buy-in here, right? So that's going to be ultimately right. The end of right. Your reform agenda.
Right.
What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, so this is why I spend some time in the book and in these conversations talking about the way in which the system doesn't serve the elite. I should say, I don't know an elite parent who thinks that the education that they are giving their children is what they want for their children. Everyone I know thinks, well, this is what has to happen if my children are going to be competitive. And they would all much rather their children had a lower stress childhood with fewer hoops to jump through, fewer hurdles to clear, more time for play. And so I think one lever in here to get elite buy-in is to say, look, you don't have to give up all your privilege. The part of your privilege you have to give up is the part that's not actually worth a lot to you. Mm. You know, it's the extra income that you don't know what to spend it on. Because you're spending it on the thing that is desirable to you only because it's fashionable, not because it actually makes your life better. And what you get in exchange for that is freedom for yourself and in particular for your kids.
Right.
And yes, I mean, there are some people who are just by nature profoundly competitive, you know, who want to dominate others. And there are some people who have found a line of work that they love so much that they want to devote themselves to it in a sort of monomaniacal way. But most people in the elite aren't like that. And so part of the idea is to offer them a trade, which makes them better off. Although, of course, the principal political motive for making that trade is not concern for the rich, but rather that if this trade could be made, the middle class and the working class would be much better off. And those are the groups that at the moment have the strongest claims for change.
Daniel Markovits, thank you so much.
Thank you so much. I hope that this was what you were after, and it was a pleasure to have the conversation.
Absolutely. Yeah, thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to the Political Economy Forum podcast. Please feel free to listen to our other episodes on iTunes, SoundCloud, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. You might also like our special podcast on election security, Neither Free Nor Fair, which is hosted by Professor James Long and is also available on all major platforms.
Our podcasts are produced by Morgan Wack and myself, Nicholas Wichtok. Our theme music was created by Ted Long.
Please feel free to leave a review as we're curious about your feedback. And if you have any questions, suggestions, or concerns, please contact uwpoliticaleconomy@gmail.com. We would love to hear from you.